The following program is brought to you by Podcast One. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Now here's your host, Rory O'Malley.
Hey, this is Rory O'Malley, your host for the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Thank you so much for listening. My guest today is the wonderful, hilarious, amazing Jamie Denbo. You know her from Beverly of Ron and Beverly podcast. She has her podcast back on Earwolf, Beverly in LA. You have to check it out. It's so funny. I actually got to be a part of it. I love Beverly. And she's also the creator and showrunner of American Princess, a show I love very much about Renaissance fairs. I happen to be in it. And it premieres on June 2nd on Lifetime. This is my conversation with one of the greatest human beings ever, Jamie Denbo. We're starting. Hi, Jamie.
Oh, hi, Rory.
It's already happening.
Oh, my gosh. It's already pressed record.
It's begun. That's right.
Oh, no. I hope you didn't hear me talk about the secret of life.
I didn't.
Okay, good.
I didn't. No, we'll keep that between us.
Behind a paywall. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Thank you for having me, Rory.
This has been a long time coming. We've been talking about this for like a year.
I have been a fan of your podcasting services to the world, to the internet waves for a while. So I have been waiting to be asked. I'm not going to lie. The text exchange when you said, hey, would you? I said, yes, before he finished. So
now I have known you through podcasting. We were like one of the first podcasters that I knew about. And I listened to a lot of interview podcasts, but you are Beverly and you're back.
From Rana and Beverly. So we had a podcast that was one of the first podcasts that was acquired by Earwolf because it was still, I mean, again, this is still within the past 10 years, and yet in podcasting, it feels like it's 50 years ago.
Yeah,
because
everything has changed
completely. And I feel like we were just lucky enough to have been a longstanding comedy act and to have been taken in by the Earwolf family, which at that time was really just Comedy Bang Bang and like two other things.
Right.
And so we were really lucky because people were looking, really looking for content. I feel like people are still looking for content, but they have a better idea of what they want. Like they know how to like search for exactly. We were just like, I don't know, comedy. And it was like it gave you us as an option.
There were no rules on what a podcast had to be. So you guys.
Correct. So we were able to just meander and be and find ourselves in that medium. It was really great. And then, you know, we sort of moved apart artistically and creatively and so on, but we're kind of off doing our own things now. So yeah, I brought Beverly back.
And you're one of your own things that you're doing right now, which is one of the reasons we're here today.
Yes, sir.
It's because on June 2nd, on Lifetime,
on the Lifetime Network,
your show that you created.
Did you say Lifetime as in the most important network on
of all
basic
time.
Cable television?
Yes.
Lifetime TV?
That's the one.
American Princess? Is that what you were going to bring
That's
up?
The show.
That is a show that I created that is starring, among others, Rory O'Malley.
That's right.
We're doing some cross promotion.
Yes.
But why not?
Absolutely.
We deserve to be here.
We do, right?
I think, I hope. I don't know if someone could turn it off.
We'll find out.
Yep. Stick around and see. Stick around and see.
But you created the show. You're the showrunner. It is, I have to say, when I read the script, I was like, this will be the most fun project ever. I hope to God I get to be a part of this one. I walked into that audition with you and Jenji Kohan sitting next to each other. I was so nervous and I was like, oh my God, I'm auditioning for Beverly.
You do not come across as nervous in an audition. And
nervous.
Just for the record, I was just telling Rory before we hit the record button that I'm 99% sure you were the first person we saw for the role that you eventually got. Playing Brian, who plays Shakespeare at the Renaissance Festival.
Right. A pretentious actor.
A pretentious actor.
Which I didn't have to do any research
for. Well, it seemed like it was kind of a stretch, really. But then we made up our mind. Like, within 5 seconds, I mean, it was like, we just looked at each other and go, I guess we're done. And I mean, we had been casting for approximately 2.5 minutes. So it was a very easy decision, and it was so, what a lovely way to start that. Because you were also the first actor cast on the show.
Yeah.
The first character that we were reading for. It was great. It was such, I mean, it's got it off to a great start, Rory, so thank you.
Oh, are you kidding me? I walked into that room just being like, I can't believe I get to meet Beverly. I get to meet Genji. I was like, oh, you know, sometimes you walk into an audition room and you're like, wah, wah, you know, this is a real bummer. Yes. But you guys were like talking to me about my life. Oh, we had such a fun time,
we're
remember?
We're such nerds, me and Genji both, and Tara, like all of the people in that company are like huge Broadway nerds.
Yeah, we talked about Broadway.
I think we had probably just seen you on your role in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which I loved you in so much. And then, you know, it was weird because I get really fangirl and I get pinched a lot on the couch in auditions because they're like, stop it. You're acting weird. I'm like, oh, I'm so happy.
Yeah, but you have a love and appreciation for actors and people in the craft. And you love Broadway, which
I do. You know. Oh my God, I do. I really, really, really do. I do.
Well, that's why I felt at home the entire time we were filming.
Yeah, I mean, the show is about, I'm glad you responded to the script that way because it's about a fun world. And I mean, I think I came by it honestly, which is also kind of a fun tidbit. You know, people don't, I think because the Renaissance Festival, and those of you who are listening are going to say, oh, I go all the time, or that sounds absurd. And are we allowed to swear on the show?
Let me check. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm getting
are you out of your fucking mind? I would never go to one of those things. And so I think there's just two responses to the Renaissance Festival thing. And so very often, most often in pop culture, it's portrayed as just the butt of the joke. You know, the nerdy sexual fetishists go and they don't know what it is. And there's Shakespeare. But
there is a lot of sexuality
for sure.
There.
But like in Shakespeare.
There you go.
Bawdiness.
Yeah.
Bawdiness.
It's an amazing place because there's something for everyone.
I couldn't agree more. And it was not a place I knew about until I went there in my very early 20s, but pretty much by accident.
But tell that story because I love this.
So I had an idea. I graduated from Boston University. The only thing I enjoyed about my college experience was the improv group. I mean, I did not know what to do with my life.
Did you study drama there?
No. I got into, yes, for 1 week. I went to the School of Fine Arts, as it was called at the time, at Boston University, and immediately was like, I don't know that I'm going to learn anything from a book, and it feels wrong. And by the way, I was completely judging myself as an actor even then. I was like, I'm not good enough, you know, so I thought I'll get a real career. So I went to the College of Communications at Boston University, which is just ridiculous.
They have books.
books about like editing on machines that don't exist anymore because now it's everything computers. I mean, it was a waste of whatever. But I got out of college and I thought, you know what? I still like performing. I like improv. Maybe I should audition for summer stock. So I went and I did the New England Theater Conference auditions, which was the open cattle call that it still is, I think. For tons of theaters.
I think I did that too.
Oh, yeah. I think everybody who went to any drama program in New England or the tri-state area.
I drove from Pittsburgh to some town outside of Boston and auditioned for
because
all these
theaters. Because they would do them in a hotel or a conference center or like a convention center, whatever. That particular year was in Boston. And I thought, well, why not? They're going to be auditioning 100 different theater companies. They're going to get their rep companies or their casts for their summer stock.
I have a very distinct memory of doing a time step in a convention center.
That sounds
like
right.
In front of a booth.
Sure.
Someone was like, can you do a time step? Show me.
I
was like, oh.
Could you?
This might be it.
We know you learned it from Mormon. Could you do it then?
I was in a process of learning.
Okay.
I was not a good tapper. I got a C in my first tap class.
I love that you got graded for tap.
Oh my God. Actually I got a D. What am I saying? I dreamed of C's. I got a D and I realized I had to take like extra classes on top of my tap class to get it up to a B. Never got better than a B.
If it wasn't adorable, it'd be very sad.
I know one tap number really well.
Which one?
The one from Book of Mormon.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one. Yep.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But go ahead.
So I auditioned for all these hundred. It's like a hundred. It's like a conference room. Imagine the Flashdance audition scene, which I know I'm dating myself. But like it's like – but imagine like 100 tables this like that.
Right.
One. So you're auditioning, doing a contemporary, a classical, and probably singing 16 bars. Who knows what the hell I did. But I was terrible enough so that I only really got one job offer, which was like you got callbacks basically, like on the hour, like they posted the callbacks and then you met with the companies. But I wasn't bummed out. I was like, oh, it's a Renaissance festival. It's like Shakespeare in the Park. Like that sounds fun.
Yeah.
And I truly went I remember in the audition room, like, you know, we did improv, and I was like, this is great. Like, they're not even going to have us read Shakespeare for this part. But then when we get there, I guess we're just going to do shit. In my brain, I just didn't. Well, we didn't have Google. I mean, it was right before sort of the internet became a way to figure shit out.
And when you're young in this business, you kind of have such high hopes that you put whatever your vision of your dream is into whatever path you're going into.
In my mind, it was like, we're going to be doing Shakespeare at a farm. Like, I had it in my head. But this is not what a Renaissance Festival is. It never was. Like, I just imagined it. And also, I had no other way to explain it to my parents. You're doing what for the summer? I was like, I'm going away for the summer. I'm going to go do Shakespeare in the Park. Great. And I drove 6 hours north to Lake Ontario and uncovered a world that I didn't know existed. And it was all the things at once. You know, because I was coming from even just doing any theater whatsoever was a bit out of the norm for where I grew up. And I grew up in a very academic little town outside of Boston. Everybody's goal was to be a very traditional doctor, lawyer, provider, worker, social psychologist.
Right.
So I was always a bit kind of offbeat. Going there, I mean, I really was introduced to a world that, again, like for me, I truly didn't understand that adults, if you're in the entertainment business and you weren't a movie star, then you were a waiter. Like that was it. There were two things, right?
One
movie star,
other.
TV star, waiter. And so this, or I guess those people who would come through on their tours through Boston every year that I saw doing falsettos or doing Les Mis or whatever. But beyond that, I just didn't understand that you could be an entertainer on so many different levels.
Yeah.
And so going to the Renaissance Festival, seeing adults dress up, play, perform, create a world for people to go to that wasn't nearly as salacious as people thought it was, and yet also had that reputation, so kind of would do it sometimes. It was a bawdy place. It was a fun place.
It had that reputation at
that
time?
Think a lot of people, because I knew that there was a Renaissance Festival once I sort of figured out what it was, which is ultimately, for those of you who don't know, it's a lot of things. It started as a hippie thing in California.
In Laurel Canyon,
In Laurel Canyon, right in California, in Los Angeles. It was a bit of like a started by a woman named Phyllis Patterson who had Shakespeare classes for kids. And a lot of the people who brought her kids there were blacklisted in the Hollywood thing. Wow. And so they were all a lot of good lefties, right?
Yeah.
And they would raise money for I think it was KPFK. It might be KPCC. Somebody's going to get mad. But it was a very lefty radio station. They would do a big benefit. And they would use this Shakespearean theme because of the Shakespeare and the art and the classes. But also it had a hippie vibe. So there was like a music element. And you could kind of bring your sitar if that's what you were into. This was like 1964.
Yeah.
And so it became this big event. And after the first year, it exploded. And it was like, it's a Renaissance Festival. And they started calling it by that. And then elements of it started to travel east across this country. A huge one erupted in Michigan. And that one was a little bit more authentic at the time. It was like, that's the one where the Shakespeare takes the precedent, not just the come as you are. And then little offshoots all over the place. And now they're 100. They're over 100.
There was one in Cleveland where I grew up.
Right.
And it was much more about like arts and crafts.
Absolutely.
And so that's what I assumed a Renaissance Fair was.
Right. So
a maypole and arts and crafts
so
all
around. Like
it.
The people who've heard of them in various parts of the country think of them differently.
I think
a lot of people in California were like, that's where hippies go to dress in corsets and give each other blowjobs.
Right.
And I was like, well, maybe, but also there's some other stuff. And also like at a different fair, like somewhere, like there was one in Massachusetts that I would see the posters for as a kid called King Richard's Fair. And I was like, I don't know what that is, but it looks awesome. And there's a king and a queen on there. And that was a fictitious fair. That wasn't even a historically accurate fair. But it was focused on the Elizabethan times, even though it wasn't actually Queen Elizabeth, which was also kind of weird. So people interpret it very differently in different places.
Right.
And the fair that I worked at when I first went was actually so authentic. History was such a huge part of it. This tiny thing in upstate New York, it's called the Sterling Renaissance Festival. It is still there. It is mom and pop, still privately owned, which many fairs are not anymore.
They're owned by like a company that produces them?
Yeah, there's different companies that that string together different groups, basically.
Right.
I mean, they're not franchises at all. In fact, they're still very independent in a lot of ways. But a lot of them are linked together. So like, for instance, the original Renaissance Fair in California is linked with the Bristol Fair in the Midwest and the New York State Fair. Mm-hmm. And they all have certain things in common and certain things that are different. And what's very interesting is, like, as it's evolved and changed over the years, there are certain elements that seem consistent. You know, cleavage abounds. Yeah. It's going to happen. Cleavage is fun. It's for everybody. You know what? Hashtag me too. Cleavage is great. Like, it's like.
I pushed up my my honeys when I was
so
there. I was
pretty. You know?
I mean, I felt really inspired.
There is an element of that. And then, honestly, like, some of the fairs, like, certain, it's going to be more family friendly between, like, the hours of 10 and 4.
For
and
sure.
then after that, everybody's drunk and having a great time. It's still relatively untouched by so many of these rules and conventions and liabilities that we see in lots of other places, and that's kind of refreshing.
Through its humor,
there's
a lot of comedy shows.
Yes.
I know there's
the Mud Show.
The Mud Show.
Oh my God.
Which is
hilariously is such a huge thing, really not in California, because because of the I think it has to do with the geology. Like, it's just
right,
because
wasn't there like some story of, like, there was just like a lot of mud?
Yes,
it
happened in the Midwest. I forget at which fair. Uh-huh. But the mud guys, basically a bunch of guys were just playing beggars on the street. This is a thing. You've got lower class, middle class, upper class at almost every fair. You've got the court and her queen, the queen, and you've got all the lords and ladies. And then you usually have townsfolk who are helping. Traditionally, if they're doing atmospheric entertainment and they're trying to entertain and try to build a world for you to immerse yourself in, they're going to help the vendors. They're going to help the food people. They're going to play with you. You know, I'm the Lord Mayor and this be my daughter. You know, they're going to be fun. It's like the queen is there for the day. You are there for the day. You're a guest of this shire. That's a typical scenario for most of these fairs. And the beggars in this particular fair, apparently it had rained and there was a puddle and they were just doing bits. They were just doing bits with this puddle. Like, there was no end. It was lo-fi entertainment. And people loved it. And they started gathering and gathering. Turns out at this particular fair, the puddle that kept on, like, refilling every time it would rain was right near the entrance, until finally the owners were like, guys, you're blocking the entrance. We're going to build you. We'll build you a mud puddle. Okay. We'll build you a mud puddle.
Right.
And that became the start of the mud shows, which are traditional. And there's different mud troops all over the place. And you can see them at most of the shows where there's more rain.
And we have a mud show in our show.
We have a mud show in our show, because our show takes place in upstate New York.
Right.
And so I don't think Texas maybe doesn't have a mud show. I'm not sure about that.
But we have so many different elements that, you know, I think that's why the show's successful, is because you wrote it out of such a place of love and understanding.
I love it.
This wasn't like in a room where, like, what if we did a show about Renaissance fairs? Someone Google Renaissance fairs and figure out what that would look like.
I so appreciate you saying that. It's 100% true.
For me, I love this world.
Well, I was like most young artists who are in their early 20s and really lost and sometimes a little mentally ill and confused about where they're supposed to be in the world.
When you first got there, were you like, wait a minute, this isn't what I thought?
I was absolutely. I was holding a complete revulsion and fascination in my head.
Right.
Because my upbringing told me this is not a way to live. This is not a way to function. These people are homeschooling their children. Some of them live in campers. They seem to be gypsies. I don't really understand how this works. This doesn't compute. This isn't what normal people do. And that's because, like, it's like, what makes this a fish out of water story is the same thing that made my life a bit fish out of water. I mean, I'm coming from a traditional Jewish middle class home where everyone sort of, all my friends have master's degree. I mean, it's like, I really went off the track, but
but they want to ask you about what you're doing now.
Oh, and
more
by the way,
anything.
I mean, so much of what you'll see in American Princesses, I mean, my friends came to visit me and they didn't know what a Renaissance was. So they were terrified. They came on me. They came upon me when I was getting my toe sucked by a biker.
As you do.
Right. Well, at that point, I had really committed to the Rennie lifestyle, and comedy
all
bits sometimes just go real far.
Yeah.
Listen, that's just how it
was. You don't have any boundaries.
None at all. And there's still a lot of, like, boundarylessness at the Ren Fair in terms of performance that is acceptable in the world we live in that you can't see anywhere else.
Right.
You know, and it's – there's something – lovely about that. Now, there's also huge changes since back in the day when I worked at the fair.
Right.
Bigger changes. Comic-Con. Nerd cool. Nerd chic.
When I went to a Renaissance fair last year, there were lots of Deadpools because it was heroes versus villains.
Sure.
So
theme weekends.
Yes. Theme weekend, which is one of our episodes, as you know, the controversy over, you know, should we, you know, have this come into our infiltrate our fair of Elizabethan Renaissance.
Well, it's the quintessential artistic dilemma. Do you embrace the change to stay alive,
right,
or do you resist it and maybe kind of become irrelevant? I mean,
right,
that's a question that I think is asked in so many places in our culture.
Yeah.
You know, and the reality is that Renfairs still tend to maintain a uniqueness in that they are fully outdoors. They have a lot of like really strong and beloved performers who do such lo-fi sword type circus act. I mean, there's so many different kinds of vaudevillian style,
yeah,
performance that you really can't see anywhere else. So what they have to do is allow for the come as you are philosophy,
right,
to keep those gates open.
Those performers, some of them,
incredible,
are who you worked with when,
sure,
you were there, are still performing.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
And so this is a whole life that people, how do they stay employed all year round?
I mean, they are almost like, the way I would put it is like they're the entertainment middle class. I mean,
yeah,
these they go from fair to fair. Usually a typical Rennie, and again, this is a very small section of the population when you really think about it, but like a typical Rennie performer will do anywhere between 3 and let's say 7 or 8 fairs a year. They will usually take off in the winter months sort of retreat to wherever they may own property,
right,
be with family, do Christmas and the holidays. Sometimes they'll do a Dickensian fair or weekend just,
right,
to, you know, continue working. And they go back season after season and to these different fairs. And that's their family. That's their path. That's their circuit and their route. And they reconvene with all the people and the family that they've made in each of these places, or a family, as it's often called.
Right.
And it's a loving community full of support, and they've all been each other's best colleagues and companions for years now, many of them, and they induct new people all the time.
In our story, the character Amanda,
mm-hmm,
who kind of finds herself in this world, who it's not you, but it's based on your experience
based
of going
into
this world. She has a moment where she's walking around the Renaissance Fair and she sees the joy in these people and the value. Did you have a moment like that where it kind of clicked for you, or did you just all of a sudden?
I had a really interesting moment.
Huh.
So I get to the fair. I think this is strange. We have a 2 or 3 week long rehearsal period where we, as the performers and the workers, the people who work in the booths and the people who work they craft and they sell food, the vendors, everybody. We're all getting together. We're learning some Elizabethan phrasing. We're practicing. Some of us are doing these little pop-up mini Shakespeare shows. We're learning sort of a lot of history. Like I said, the fair that I worked at was very they loved authenticity, which I,
right,
still have so much love and respect for, because history was such a big part of it. We learned so much about the Elizabethan era and what was going on and everything. So we're preparing for this thing. And
yeah, we're just doing a little song.
Oh, that's a nice song. Ooh, what's that?
They're Skyping's in another one.
No problem.
So we can't hear that.
Oh, that's why. Got it.
So anyway, it was a very beautiful thing to prepare for this. Because I'm there and I'm like, this is great. Our wardrobe, our costumes are gorgeous. They've got these beautiful things. We get to the opening day. And I'm playing the Lord Sheriff of Warwickshire, his daughter, right? So I'm supposed to be like the bad girl of the Shire, which,
yeah,
is super fun for me. I'm being sort of a nasty, spoiled Elizabethan brat.
Right.
And the woman who's playing my mom, who's this wonderful actress, we get there and we go through the opening day motions. You know, we're standing in the parade and we're letting all the guests in. And I see that the guests are wearing costumes. And I am completely floored. I'm,
yeah,
like, but I don't, we're wearing the costume.
Yeah.
Why are they wearing
the
costume?
We're on the stage.
We're the performers.
Yeah.
And I turned to her and I was like, who let in the freaks? And she was like, I'm mistress. It be their Leidenschaft. It be their, be their love, their passion.
Yeah.
It be their joy. And I was like, oh. And in that moment, I sort of realized that to get through the day, I was going to have to put aside my judgment, because to me, I had never seen cosplay. Cosplay was not a word when I was there. This is now 20 years ago. So, I mean, to me, it was just so confusing. I was like, I don't understand. I mean, I know we're supposed to be. I know that we had been rehearsing in a way that would incorporate people into our little comedy bits and we would welcome them and make them feel like they were part of this world. But I was shocked that they would wear costumes. And by the way, how I'd walk by the costume rental place 5,000 times and never noticed it, also indicative of how narcissistic I was. But it was when, by the end of that day, when I realized how joyful it was for these people. And, you know, believe me, even when my parents came, I mean, I remember my parents coming and just going like, who are these people that are wearing these costumes? Yeah. I mean, can you imagine Beverly at the Renaissance? Why are they dressed up? Why? You don't work here. You're a schmuck. Although, you know what? Yours is better than the Queen.
Right, right.
And so it was all this huge mix of social rules that I felt like I already understood that was completely turned upside down.
Yeah.
And maybe some people just need to be shocked into that. I mean, I like myself a lot better now that I have such less judgment. I can have humor about it, but the judgment part of it is really gone. And a lot of it went away that summer.
Yeah.
So when we were thinking of how to bring this into a modern story, it felt really appropriate because it's obviously a story I've wanted to tell for a very long time.
Yeah.
I've wanted to tell it since I was there. But I always said, I describe my experience as Private Benjamin at the Renaissance Festival. Mm. For those of you who are listening who don't know what Private Benjamin is, go rent it.
And watch Goldie Hawn.
Now.
Genius.
Thank you. But to me, it was like, I knew it was a story I wanted to tell. The timing ultimately for this version was so perfect because to have this, you know, social media conscious, you know, sort of spoiled girl who, you know, I feel badly when we talk about young people, and I don't want to say millennials because that feels kind of whatever, but this idea that like they're putting their whole life online, what I really see it as is like you're opening yourself up to not making any mistakes.
Yeah.
Why? Don't, careful. You want people, you want to be able to make mistakes.
Yeah.
You don't want people to notice if you've gone offline for maybe you're having a mental breakdown. Like people are going to notice if you're no post six selfies.
Yeah.
You know, so I felt like it really works for a character, the story, who is really on a very specific path and has a family that's very rigid about who she is and what she should be doing and has friends that are very conscious of who they are and what they're doing. And it's a very, very, very structured life.
Yeah, I love that there's such a social structure and hierarchy in her world, and she comes into this Renaissance fair and it's completely flipped around.
Completely.
Like my character, Brian, along with, you know, the Queen Elizabeth,
yes,
we were the biggest nerds
in high
school by far.
Yes.
And now we're the queen bee bitches.
That's right. Y'all in charge of that shit.
You know, so and it's interesting to see what happens when those people are given that power all of a sudden.
It,
you know, we don't always use it nicely.
Well, but you don't. And then you do. I mean, listen, what we wanted to do was take this really interesting premise based in truth about prejudgment and assumptions and where that takes you and give everyone the opportunity to flex their dimensions, you know?
Right.
And I think what was really fun is as you all brought so much life to these characters, it became so fun to think about who they are. Where are their missed opportunities? Where have they become judgmental?
Right.
Who are they? Where were they when they started doing the Renaissance Festival? Was it, you know, I think it's very interesting because eventually you see that characters that really love this life and then some that feel like it's maybe a cop-out.
Hmm.
You know, you see the range of people. You know, they're all flawed and they're all human. And
right.
It's no different than any workplace in some ways.
Absolutely.
But for our, you know, we wanted to put a really extreme personality in there to start because like Jenji Kohan has said many times on the record about Orange is the New Black, you know, one of the beautiful things about Piper is that she's your Trojan horse.
Yeah.
You know, you get in there because, you know, so many people can't imagine what it would be like to go into prison. So
right.
You pick a character who can't imagine what it'd be like to be going to prison, and then you follow her in.
Yeah.
And then you see who's the real, what's really going on.
I did this really weird thing when I finished watching Orange is the New Black in like 3 days or whatever it was, you know, the first time you could binge something on Netflix. I remember I started watching the first episode again because it was just a few days later. I was like, I just want to see the first episode again. And all of a sudden, there are all these characters who I know so well now just passing by Piper in the hall. And you're like, oh my gosh, the journey that she's going to go on over the next 13 episodes.
Isn't that fun?
I can't believe that I didn't even look at her that first episode. I was looking at this Piper woman, and here's the most interesting person, you know?
And I can tell you, as a creator, what one of the biggest joys is finding someone in one of those smaller roles earlier on and then being like, oh, we're going to run this character around. Yeah. And it's so fun because you fall in love with the way the actor plays this character, and suddenly it's just one.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I've got some great ideas, because you get inspired, and it's so lovely.
Well, you know, like the character that I play in the pilot, I think there's like six lines or something. Uh-huh. I was like ready to go. I was like, wherever these people – no, no. I was like, wherever they want to take me, mm-hmm. I know what Genji did with those characters and where her writers will take these kind of characters. And that's why I signed on, because I was like, I know that there's no character that would just be thrown aside.
One of the most exciting things about being in the Genji, Kohan, Tara Herman production world – is that when you look at their track record, it is so, it is that it's everything you're saying. It's like somebody could pop up as, you know, I think Rachel Bloom has done this too.
Yeah.
You know, somebody can pop up as a clerk or a you know, tiny little audience member, and before you know it, that person is like the star of episode 7.
Right.
Like it just, and it gives you a certain freedom of creativity that I don't know. Maybe, hopefully it's consistent in other places, but I feel so lucky.
Yeah.
You know, I think Rachel Bloom did that really beautifully in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. You know, you would see somebody in the third episode and then they'd come back. You'd be like, oh my God, I forgot how much I love that person. And now they have more to do.
Yeah.
You know, and now they have a song.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So. Well, I mean, it's one of the things that made the experience of working on American Princess with you. And I say this knowing that I've gotten the privilege of working on some really cool things.
Yeah,
it was one of the greatest professional experiences of my life.
Take
truly,
that,
truly, truly.
Lin-Manuel Miranda. I'm going to cry.
Well, you know, like sometimes there's I have such value placed in different things at this point in my career and in my life. And the fact that I was getting to get a script sent to me and be like, where is this character going next? And the fact that I was playing a gay man who, you know, no spoilers, but was really being fully realized.
Oh, yeah.
That had never happened to me before, Jamie. Ugh. I don't know if I really, I don't think in the moment I explained that to you, because
well,
it was kind
we
of like a
about
lot.
Making you the best friend neighbor who came in and gave sassy comments.
Exactly.
But
hey,
then I thought, let him do something else.
Yeah. I mean, that the fact that I was able to go on a romantic journey.
Oh.
I'll say
yeah,
say
that.
Yeah,
that's okay.
That
I think there's
was
a little moment
something
in the trailer that gives that away.
Yes, yeah. That's true. That's true.
So that makes me so happy.
I'm glad that I understood how important that was and how to enjoy every single second of it. So that, you know, when we were filming in Simi Valley in
115,
that was the record, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember I actually drove to set that day.
And your tires melted?
Yeah, yeah. It was like, it was the end of the day. I think the sun went down when I was supposed to start filming, and it was 105.
Uh-huh.
I was like, okay, if this is what it's like when it's dark.
I have to tell you something. We truly had part of what I think made this work, and again, like, it's not, it's the world that we were portraying is a community full of people on a team working together to make something really special in a moment without being, it's a very unselfish community. People are always, if it's based in improv, which so much of that world is, you're trying to make everybody else look good.
Yeah.
And somehow the subject matter did pervade the set. And and I feel very, very grateful because people got it.
Yeah.
And look, we had a no asshole policy that seemed to hold up.
Yeah.
And we had one, I mean, I feel very fortunate to have had the subject matter and the cast and the crew and everything match itself in sensibility.
And when you say the cast, we're not talking about like three other actors.
No.
You have an army.
I have an
of
army.
Brilliant actors in the show. Like
yep.
every day I would show up and be like, oh my God, there's like a dozen brilliant actors in this scene just having fun with each other. And
I have never seen a more professional and exceptionally enthusiastic group of background.
Yeah.
And part of that was, I think, that they got to play. So much of my experience at the Renaissance Festival is summarized in the term the art of play.
Yeah.
which was by one of my first directors, wrote a book called The Art of Play. And it was about not just immersive improv as a performance-oriented thing, but as a invitation for the audience to play with you. You are the main leader because you are the performer, but you are welcoming them into that. And that spirit just was there. I mean, it really was. And so many of our background, and we had people in every department who had an association with the Renaissance Festival circuit. We had people, guys in construction. We had a lot of our background actors. We had some of our actors who were speaking. I mean, we had wonderful, wonderful. We had consultants from the actual Renaissance Festival to really bring the authenticity level up. But there seemed to be, I think, an acknowledgement, too, that this is a real world and this is a three-dimensional world and not the butt of the joke like it is in the one Ren Faire episode of every other series that you've ever seen.
Right. No, it is. There is a joy and a love for this world, and that's why the show works.
I also feel like even as someone who, you know, I still perform here and there. I still do Beverly. I occasionally improvise. But I'm not professionally acting anymore as much, which is kind of delightful because I don't have to schlep across the Fox lot in heels for auditions that I'm not going to get. So, which is actually great. But what's interesting about it is like what I want to tell the people too is, especially when they're so aspirational, I want to be in entertainment and they have a certain barometer, a certain idea of what success is.
Right.
There are so many ways to be a performing artist. And I think that was one of the biggest revelations that I had when I came to the Ren Faire is there are people that will perform for one person and that is a performance and it has value. And you know what? The person you're performing for, if you do a tiny little bit with someone on the street at the Ren Faire, you do a little bit where you know, give them a bow or whatever. I went to the Ren Faire with my kids recently.
Yeah.
And a guy who was dressed as a Puritan. There's always a group of like Puritans who are like condemning the bad behavior of all of ye sinners.
As the gay man, I was going the other way.
Yes, correct. Like, oh, exactly. God. Of course. So like they came and said, they're just like, ma'am, put that child away. He did some crazy bit. But like I remember his face. I remember I laughed. My son laughed. He was performing for two people.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most memorable moments of the day.
Yeah.
And that has value.
Yeah.
And the idea that like that has less value than a movie with a blockbuster movie, like it doesn't really.
No, and certainly it's more pure.
Oh my God!
To you know the joy and love,
the connection.
Of what it was
taught at that age when I went to the Ren Faire that has so you're making people's days.
Yeah.
You are creating moments for them, and that is why you're here.
I think that's why so much of every day was just pure joy for everyone, even though it was 115 degrees, is because you were able to access what it feels like when you're having that moment, and that's why you do it, for the fun, for the joy, and for the community.
Yeah.
And that certainly was,
I mean,
was
there's
all
no
summer long. And I think that's going to translate in the show.
I hope so. I hope so. Listen, it's also a show, generally, it's about kindness. It's a kind culture.
Yeah.
And like, we kind of need a little kindness right now.
Ugh.
I mean, there's a lot of mean. A lot of mean. And I love mean. I'm a mean person. I hate everybody. You should have seen me in my car 10 minutes ago. But I do think it's okay to find these kind places to represent and to remind people that you can slow down. You can look at pretty costumes and you can smile at each other. There's a lot of eye contact at the Ren Faire. We don't do that anymore.
No. Did you feel like you went from the Renaissance Fair and you went into UCB in the improv world? Did you feel like that was just so much easier because of your Renaissance Fair experience?
Oh, my God. I felt like – no. I feel like I was – first of all, here's – you skipped a weird step.
Oh.
Went from the Renaissance Festival to work in Disney in Orlando because, as it turned out, atmospheric entertainment and theme park entertainment, very similar, a lot of immersive performance stuff. One of the directors at the Sterling Renaissance Festival used to bring up all the guys from Disney to audition everybody because they were performers that know how to work with crowds. We could be great MCs in the parks and stuff like that. Not head characters, but like doing more themed entertainment, right? And what's really – two things are funny. I did get hired, and I eventually went on to Disney. And what was kind of great about that transition, it was like my parents didn't understand the Ren Faire, but I was like, I'm working for Walt Disney World Corporation. And they were like, that makes sense. Good for you.
I tell you something? My mom told me when I was in Cleveland that I should learn Spanish because then I could work at Disney World when I was like in second grade. And I wasn't even acting. Like I don't know why she said that.
Well,
I did it. I didn't get the job at Disney World.
Did you speak
Spanish? See. Moving on.
It was a similar vibe with better pay and benefits and things like that.
Yeah.
So I actually wound up working in Orlando. One thing very interesting, there was a derogatory term for Renaissance Festival workers who came to work at Disney, and they would call us mudwalkers, which I thought was very funny. It was a dirty word, which is hilarious.
To kind of be like they're separate from
us.
Yeah,
like they didn't come up like through the basically like the regional theaters of America.
Right.
So they're kind of below us. It's very funny, the little hierarchy there. But what was very interesting about that is I sort of went from this freedom and this interesting sort of like anything goes culture to improvising and in a very corporate structure. So that was wild. And then I saved enough money to go to New York. And I went to New York and I got involved with the Upright Citizens Brigade right after they'd gotten to New York City. It was one of the most incredible times of my life. I met amazing comedians, most of whom have more money than me now. They're all great. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting was I was made to feel very, it was a very, how do I put this? Let's see. At that time, it was very straight white boy alternative comedy.
Well, I was going to say a lot of those guys you're saying have a lot of money.
Sorry.
Those are dudes. Those are dudes.
Yeah.
And I watched you this summer just completely in your element.
Yeah.
Just killing it.
Thanks.
Thinking, I'm glad that you're having this moment, and we can't look back and be like, oh, this or that. But it should have happened for you even sooner because you've been ready for this.
Thank you. It was hard to be a woman in comedy. There was one woman on The Daily Show at a time. Let's put it that way. And she was replaced by another crazy lady who just was too crazy for The Daily Show at the time. You know, that was the only game in town, and SNL. And, you know, I'm not going to bemoan the, you know, straight white alternative comedy 90s and aughts. But what it meant for me was that when I came in, if you said you worked in a Renaissance festival, it's like those guys were like, oh, what are you talking about? Like you were basically completely bullied in a very comedic and very snazzy, zippy way. But it was something that people thought was weird. And it was the same way that, to be honest, like if I'd come in and said I was doing only musical theater.
Absolutely.
And now I want to
be a comic. I was going to say there's only one reason that people don't like belittle my musical theater. It's because of two of the plays that I'm
correct.
In. Otherwise, they're like, oh, that's sweet.
Oh, how cute. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
When
and, like,
I moved to L.A.
You don't know anything about real comedy.
When I moved to L.A., my manager said, musical theater will be the death of you, Rory. Simply the death. And, you know, I was like, oh, well, I really like singing, so keep doing
it. Well, Julie Klausner, who is dedicated an ongoing fan for my life, put it in a book of hers. She described being a woman in improv comedy at that time was like basically being Miss Piggy. Now, no one denies that Miss Piggy is funny. She is also completely unapologetically feminine. She loves to sing. She loves to, and she's very loud. And Kermit is so embarrassed of her. His friends are like, your pig is fucking, you got to control your pig.
Yeah.
Like, she's too annoying and she's loud and she's with the boobs and it's too much. And with the pink and the gloves, stop.
Right.
And that's what I think I could relate to. Like, when Julie said that, I was like, oh my God. Yeah, I'm a Miss Piggy.
Right.
Renfair, way more Miss Piggy than alternative comedy.
Yeah.
So I didn't really talk about it much. Like I didn't, it wasn't, I mean, I went back to do a couple of weekends at the fair, but they were totally different lives, you know? And what was good about that is in a way I was learning how to be the cool comedy kid, but I don't know that I completely fit in there either. So, you know, it was interesting, you know,
Did you meet and you met John at UCB?
I did. I met John.
You met your husband.
In the level 2 improv class. Yeah,
that's quite the.
It was back in the day
class.
When like it was a wild class. A lot of people that you would know. Yeah,
I bet.
It was very small. I mean, the community was so small then. It was like that thing of the tipping point where it's like it was before it became 100 people and you didn't know anybody's name anymore.
Right.
It was a great time to be in New York City.
People will know John from Speechless on ABC and Big Bang Theory, a bunch of great projects that he's a part of. We were talking about this before we started about being with our partners.
Oh, yes.
What mine is not in the business, yours is.
Yes.
What do you think is the benefit of being with somebody who is so successful in this business?
Yeah.
You both have done so many things and you've really had careers that have really you've been able to support each other, but are there downsides to that?
You know what? It was funny. I think back in, you know, maybe 10, 20, oh, fuck, how long have we been there? Oh my God.
What day is it?
I think when we started out, okay, we'll have been married for 15 years the summer. And we've been together for longer. So when we first started out, and I think we knew we were going to be together for the long haul, I'm not sure that, you know, it was, it's an unhealthy business anyway, because right. so much of it is, you know, serving your sense of validation. And we definitely, like, he would book something and I would be like, oh my God, I'm a loser. It wasn't even about him. It was just like the proximity to someone doing really well
Absolutely.
Was very confusing. But eventually, like, you really, if you're lucky and you love each other and you're really, it really does become a team. And before you know it, you're just, thank God somebody is working, like pay yeah. for my meal. And, and I mean, it's practical, but it's also, you're so excited to share in it. You really do feel like you're part of it. I mean, yeah. it's impossible not to. And then once you have children and once you get older and your true like vanity, all of that stuff really does start to fade in the best possible way. So you just are sharing each other's joys, especially like, are you kidding? If anything, it's like, thank God he's doing well, because it keeps him in a better mood.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, or vice versa. And yeah. I think like the benefits, of course, are that we completely understand what the other person is going through.
Yeah.
It's like, no one understands the business. I don't have to explain, you know, the difference between a pilot and a finale. You know, there's a lot of that, the
yeah.
common language. And John and I, listen, I can't speak for everyone. We're just really good friends, too.
Yeah.
You know, we've always found each other genuinely funny, thank God. I've also always believed in his talent. This is the other thing, is I think sometimes if you believe that you're more talented than the person that you're with, it's never going to work.
Yeah.
Because then their success will never make any sense to you. Because you're always going to be uneven. Someone's always going to be doing well. Someone's always going to be in. If you're lucky, people are doing great at the same time. And it's very rare. And sometimes it happens. Sometimes it doesn't. But I have never, especially like, you know, when we've gone through these stretches without work, you know, my belief in him has never waned. I've been like, well, they're wrong. I mean, this sucks because you're not working and we don't have a lot of money and
yeah.
we're struggling and we have another baby all of a sudden, you know, but it's never because of something you're doing. It's never something he's doing. And so that to me is the most important thing. If you don't believe that person, if you don't believe in there as an artist, then you're in that you've got to get out of that relationship.
Right.
If that's the relationship.
Speaking of babies, you have two of them. They're not babies anymore.
No, they're not babies anymore.
They are really
so
awesome kids.
Fast. Thanks, Rory.
I just really think you and John are doing such a good job.
Oh,
and doing it in Los Angeles, which just like, I'm, you know, starting to figure that out, but it just scares me.
You know
like,
who was
how
instrumental in that? Jenji Cohan. She is
really?
A wonderful, wonderful parent.
Which is probably why we talked about kids like for my entire audition.
I'm telling you. With you of course,
yeah.
because it was so funny. I mean, she was like, she's yeah. thrilled to have people. I mean, this is a working woman who had a nursery in her office for her writers that
right.
were nursing. Like, this
right.
is a very pro-parenting woman. But I worked with her initially on the original Rana and Beverly pilot for Showtime in 2008
right.
or 2009. And it was just after I'd had my first kid, and I remember looking at her going like, she is an amazing, she had her third kid and he was like three, and I met her children. They were so precocious, they were so privileged but appreciative of
yeah.
the world that they were given. And I thought, well, that's an amazing phenomenon that I don't see up close too often. And I thought, I hope I can learn from her. And
right.
so I made her be my friend. Now I trapped her.
Yeah.
But what's amazing is that you do eventually when you're out there in the world with your child
yeah.
in Los Angeles, you really do gravitate to the normal people. You really
yeah.
do. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You're not going to get
No,
up.
I mean, that's how you, with anything in this city, you have to like gravitate towards the people who seem sane.
Every parent in this day and age, whether they are in small town America or Los Angeles, is out of their minds right
yeah.
now. We have been made crazy by the internet. We've been made crazy by the world.
Yeah.
We have been made crazy by phones. We have been made crazy by all of it. And it's more just about like being, not forgetting who you are and listening to your own parental voice.
Right. Well, we have to wrap up here, but
no.
I want to. No, I know. Come on. This is just part one. we'll be doing a weekly podcast in no time. You
Terrific.
And me, Jamie.
But it's only about my life.
Only about
we
Jamie.
We will never run
which
out
is,
of material.
Never, never.
They're going to love it.
But
me.
I want to say publicly,
oh,
I've kind of said this to you before, that I'm so happy that the show was run by women. Because I think that those are the stories that I want to hear right now, one. But secondly, because it was such an important environment for me. I don't think I've talked about this publicly, but I, in that audition, the reason that we talked about babies is because I was about to become a dad. I'd been in the adoption process for a long time. And I think that was in February, and I was planning on having a child in June. Mm-hmm. And that ended up being while we were filming the second episode. And on set, I got a call saying that I wasn't going to get that baby, that the mother had changed her mind after 6 months of talking to her. And I was on set for that. And it was one of the most devastating days of my life. And the entire crew, you, everyone from Genji to everyone working on it, they embraced me and carried me through it. And I think that doing the show saved me through that period. It saved my husband because we had something so wonderful and positive
it
at that
so
time.
It was so heartbreaking.
It was so heartbreaking. And now, you know, like we can talk about it and be like, oh, now I have a baby.
And it turned out exactly as it should.
And I have my baby,
never,
Jimmy.
You don't know that when it's happening.
No,
and
no.
Yeah, I will say this. You were on a set. I mean, like I said, I knew Genji to be the kind of executive producer that family first.
Yeah.
And I know this from the way that she has run her writer's rooms and the way that she taught me and the way that she's, you know, crossed over to Tara and how they create. It's like the more babies, the better.
Yeah.
I mean,
From day one. But I had to set up this period of time where I had to ask for time off to go get that potential child. And they were so good to me and made sure that I had that time off. So then 2 days before, when I had this whole weekend of nothing to do, I basically was able to kind of grieve with my husband at home. And a lot of people give you advice when you have this. I'm sorry, I'm telling the story. A lot of times people say, like, you know, that wasn't your baby. Your baby's out there. And they, you know, you're kind of like, thanks a lot. And you're kind of gritting your teeth like, I'm tired of hearing this. And you walked up to me and you said, fuck that baby.
For real, fuck that baby.
Your baby is going to be so much better than that baby.
That baby is lame.
I laughed so hard. I called my husband immediately. I was like, Jamie just said the only thing that's making me happy right now. And it, you know, I told my mom that, you know, my mom laughed. We needed the laugh. And, you know, it's kind of like what the show is. We needed that escape. We needed this world. And you slapped me back into laughing.
Oh,
and I'll never, ever forget you saying that to me. And I'm so grateful that I was surrounded by my Rennies, by my family. And so now, you know, we went out to dinner with a bunch of our friends from the show, and we were able to bring Jimmy, my son, and that just meant so much to me.
That's the most important thing.
It is. And you know what? That's why, you know, you're one of the same people. As crazy as you are, Jamie Denbo, you are definitely one of the same people, and I adore you, and I could not be more proud to be a part of your dream, American Princess, airing June 2nd on Lifetime.
Anyone who hears this better give us a second season.
Yes, right?
But I do.
Come
thank
on.
You. I feel the same way. I'm so grateful. It was it was an incredibly special experience. I hope it translates. I think it does.
It will. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I can't wait to see it.
Hey, Rory.
Hey.
Fuck that other baby.
There you go.
Love it.
Jamie Denbo.
Amazing.
Thank you so much for listening to my talk with Jamie Denbo. Please make sure to download, subscribe, rate, review, do all the things you need to do, and make sure just tell your friends about the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. We will be back with some more wonderful conversations. See you then.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every month right here on Podcast One, on the Podcast One app, or on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate, review, and share.